Good morning. A bit of advice we give to people who are beginning to learn to give lessons and things is to relate to things that you already know. And with my new job, it's almost like when two parents get a sitter and go out for a date, they finally get some alone time and they end up talking about the kids. So I finally get away from work and I'm going to tell you all about work. A little background. Many of you know I started a new job several months ago. I was an electrician, and now I've become an instructor. It's the same program that I went through to become an electrician, 5-year program to become a commercial electrician. We also teach a 3-year program for residential electricians and a 3-year program for telecom guys. Oddly enough, I end up teaching all those guys, so it's different. But it's quite a change of pace from what I was used to. Just so you know, kind of a little background about it, the way the program works is an apprentice gets in into the program, their first day they're on the job site. They send them out there with people who actually know what they're doing so they don't get killed, and they teach them on the job, and then 5 times a year they come in to us for a week to do coursework. So every time they're in, we give them a little sheet that says this is what to do next time, and then they have that homework done when they come in, and it just works like that. So I've made a few observations about the new job and some parallels that exist between that and our walk with Christ, and so that's what I'll be sharing with you this morning. So the first and most obvious thought I had was what came to mind the first time I had test to correct. When I use this little red pen, do I mark the ones I got right or the ones I got wrong? Wrong. I'm right. You guys are right, but I mark the ones I get wrong. You got to be clear. We draw attention to the problems I got wrong. We highlight the failures instead of the victories. I've thought about just once going through and circling every one they got right, counting them up and putting plus this many instead of minus at the top, except for all the students to have a heart attack when I handed them their test back and they saw all the red marks. Because even a failing grade, they get 3 times as many right as they get wrong. To pass, they have to have 76 or better. So when they fail a test, they still have almost 3 times as many right as they get wrong. But what does it say at the top? It says minus this many. So the reason I don't do it that way is to prevent heart attacks on the part of my students, and I'd go through a lot more red pens because I'd mark 3 times as many. But we do the same thing as Christians. I think it goes to we have this desire to be humble, which is appropriate. We shouldn't think of ourselves more highly than we ought. Romans 12:3 says, "For by the grace given me, I say to every one of you, do not think of yourself more highly than you ought, but rather think of yourself with sober judgment in accordance with the faith God has distributed in each of you." It doesn't say, think of yourself as dirt. It says, don't think of yourself as higher than you ought. So it implies that we should acknowledge God's help in our successes. So when we do well, we don't say, oh, I'm super wonderful, and discount God's part in that. But we also remember that we had a part in that success. It's interesting to me that we take responsibility for all of our sin, but we're hesitant to take responsibility for all of our successes. When we have a trial and we get through that trial successfully, we don't want to say that was us. Good job, Derek. But when I fail, I want to say that was bad, Derek. You know, I don't want to put any of that anywhere else. And the truth is kind of in the middle. The truth is I'm influenced by God or Satan, right? I allow one or the other to influence me, and I make the choice because I've got free will, because I'm made in God's image and He gave that to me. So I'm responsible for my failures and successes and who I let influence me, whether it's God or Satan. So that's the first thing. The second observation is I really want the students to do well, but I have to grade them based on what they gave me. I grade them based on their actual performance, their answers, not my estimation of their potential or how much I like them or how much I want to help them. When I've got my little red pen out, if it's wrong, I have to check it wrong. And that's really hard. I underestimated how hard that was. Because when you get to know people, it's like having hundreds of children. They're just big children. Because all my students are at least technically adults. So most of the young men and women that come through our program are really likable people. And you get to know them pretty well. You get to know their stories. And it would be easier for me to grade them if I couldn't see the name at the top of the paper. But I can see the name. And sometimes there are circumstances that make it hard for them to score well. We had a gal in this last week. She's a single mom. The last time she was in, she failed a test, and she was upset about it. And her contractor had laid her off. And so she was waiting to find out where they were going to send her next, because the apprenticeship places them at different places. And she got placed in Marshalltown at the power plant going in up there, which is about an hour each way, and they're working 10-hour days. That's pretty hard on a single mom who's trying to study and do her homework. So she came in this last week, and I really wanted to do well, but I could see she was stressed. You could just see it. Just look over there, and you could just... It was palpable. So if I'm correcting her test, and I come to a question that she looks like she's getting close to failing, I find myself looking for a question that a lot of people miss, that maybe isn't worded very fairly, or something that maybe has more than one correct answer. And sometimes I'll find one, but that's rare, because I have a standard that has to be legitimately an unfair question. So that's rare. But I find myself wanting to do that. And even though I feel bad about giving them that paper back, they're responsible for their errors, not me. Okay. Most of the time I've looked at the test, and I try not to teach just what's on the test, because the point of a test is to judge your overall learning. So if all I taught them was the 25 questions that are on their test, then they're going to have real limited knowledge. That's why we don't teach to the test. But I've looked at it, and if there's something out of left field, I'll hammer that 3 or 4 times. I'll throw it in there just so they have a fighting chance, and then they miss it. And I'll repeatedly remind them to read the questions carefully. Read them carefully. Watch every word. One word can be the difference between which answer you pick. And inevitably, some will miss the ones that should have been gimmies or fail to read the question carefully. There are at least 2 takeaways from that for us as Christians. The first is, if you are in a leadership position, or if you're a parent, you have to lead and teach the best you can, but you are not in control of the people who you're teaching and leading. They'll make their own decisions. Some will be wrong, even when they were taught right. We're not programming a machine. We're trying to influence a fellow creature who is made in God's image and has free will. So they can choose God's will, or they can choose their own. The second takeaway that I see is that we are each responsible for our own performance. This is the same situation from the other perspective. If I'm the child that's been taught, whether I was taught well or not, I'm responsible for my own performance. My faith and my actions are my own. I didn't inherit them. Some of us had the benefit of teaching that others didn't. But ultimately, it's my choice what I do with that. We've seen people that grew up around godly teaching that left. We've seen other people that grew up in terrible circumstances and came to Christ. Why? It's because they're responsible for their own performance. So it's my choice what I do, and it's my choice who I let influence me, whether it's Satan or Christ. Philippians 2:12 says, "Therefore, my dear friends, as you have always obeyed, not only in my presence, but now much more in my absence, continue to work out your salvation with fear and trembling. For it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose." And even that last part, even though I'm responsible, it says it is God who works in you to will and to act in order to fulfill his good purpose. If I choose to let God be the one that influences me, then I have help. So it's my decision, but I can have help if I choose. A lot of these observations have to do with testing, because that's like the most stressful part of the deal. My third one is, I absolutely hate handing back a failed test. Hate it. Hate it with a passion. I do it about every other time I teach. There's at least one that fails. The first week I had a class of my own, we had three tests that week. Everyone did all right on the first one, but on the second I had two people fail it. Two people failed sitting right next to each other. I don't think they were cheating. I think they both underestimated it. You know, they were friends. And I handed those back, and one of them turned red instantly. He was mad. He wasn't mad at me. He was mad at him, because he could see the stupid ones he'd missed. He misread this. I knew that. The other one, you could just see, is that opposite. You could just see the blood drain out of his face, like he was almost sick. Failing a test is seen as a pretty serious matter. If you fail a test, you have to go talk to the director sometime that week before you leave for the week, and he'll give you some counseling, which is either find out what's wrong, why are you having struggles, or put the fear of God in you if he already knows what's wrong and it's a motivation issue. And then they have to go in front of their committee. The committee we have is six or seven people and the director. So you go in front of this group of people, and it's really intimidating. And you have to kind of explain what was going on. If this becomes a pattern and the committee sees them over and over for failed tests, they can be removed from the program. A lot of them are staking their livelihood on this program. If they're a fourth or fifth year student, they've got years invested in this. So, but as much as I hate handing my students back a failed test and all the drama and stress it creates for them, if I could change it, I wouldn't. And the reason is because the students need it that way. If a student is struggling, it should be a serious matter, because that's what gets it resolved, is treating it as a serious matter. If it's ignored, things get worse. The way our curriculum is structured, what we teach in the first year is built on in the second. What we teach in the second is built on in the third. If it doesn't get resolved, then they won't be able to do the work further down, and they'll get cut later on. So you need to deal with it right now. They have to be able to absorb what they're supposed to be learning, because otherwise you won't have the foundation when you have to go further. And if the problem is that the student just isn't capable of processing what we're teaching, then it's a lot better they figure that out early than late, so they can take some other path. So is it hard on the students? Yes, absolutely. Is it in their best interest? Yes, it is. Matthew 18:15. If your brother or sister sins, go and point out their fault just between the two of you. If they listen, you have won them over. So when I hand back a failed test, the purpose of the test is to figure out where they're at. Are you learning the material? Or is your understanding greater than it was? As Christians, if we have a brother in a fault that isn't where he's supposed to be, and we have to admonish him, that is not something that we should enjoy. We should be well aware of our own failings. We should be mindful of the kind of reaction we might get. But when it comes to serious problems, it's better to deal with them sooner rather than later. Is it stressful and unpleasant? Yes. Is it hard on your brother? Yes. Is it in his best interest? Yes. Now, having said this, we should ask ourselves, are we the ones to do this? It needs to be done. It's important. But maybe we're not the ones to do it. In the apprenticeship, this is done by a committee. So there's two important things about the committee. The first is, the committee's role is not just to crack down. The committee's role is to find out what the problem is. Okay? So the first point we take away from this is they start asking questions to find out what's really going on. They're not going to crack down on somebody and then find out they just lost their mother or something like that. They're going to find out what's going on first. They don't start out with accusations or threats of discipline. They give the person a chance to explain themselves. So when we approach a brother in a fault, we should first tell them what we've observed and ask them what's going on. What does this mean? Because we have to remember it's entirely possible for me to misinterpret what I'm seeing. Okay? You see someone, you know, we've used the seeing someone walking into or out of a bar several times. If I see one of you walk out of a bar, does that mean you have a drinking issue? No. Maybe you had a coworker you wanted to talk to, and that's where he was headed, so that's where you went. You know, there are lots of different explanations for things, and we shouldn't jump to conclusions, but rather we should give our brethren the benefit of the doubt. The second is that the committee has authority over the apprentice. But since the Lord's church is a volunteer army, mostly what we have is influence. So I can't treat a person the same way as the committee might treat them. The committee might say, okay, we've heard you out. It sounds like the problem is you're just not putting in the time. You're not putting in the effort. You're not treating it seriously. You're underestimating how strenuous the program is. Suck it up or you won't be here anymore. You can't do that to a brother. It's a volunteer army. So since our primary tool is influence, we need to consider if we have enough influence with that person to attempt to help them, or if we should seek help from church leadership or find someone else who does have or does seem to have that influence with them. So the observation points out that it's important to take care of it quickly, but it comes with the warning that a lot of conflicts have come about because someone assumed they knew what was going on and called out a brother publicly. And how, why, and by whom are all important considerations, or else we might kill the patient though we're trying to cure the behavior. So, okay, the next observation is each week I see the results of natural abilities put to good use, and I see the results of pride. So this last week, I saw an apprentice who he had his first class on the National Electrical Code. Some of you in here have seen that. And the National Electrical Code is an intimidating text. It's probably about 800 or 900 pages, and it's not easy to navigate, and it has a lot of technical stuff in it. And we have a whole field called codology that's all about how to find things in the code. And I saw an apprentice who, this is his very first class. He got 100% on both the tests. He found multiple references for every answer. It was really impressive. I wasn't sure I could have done that well. And he had a natural talent, but he worked really hard. And the week before last, I saw one apprentice who is easily capable of getting mid-90s on what we were studying, and he bombed it. He was under 70%. He felt good about it when he handed it in. He just totally underestimated how hard it was and skimmed the question instead of reading it, and he just kind of blew it. And in the same class, I had someone else who'd struggled early in the week, and he was coming in early, and he was going home late. And he did that 2 or 3 times. He did phenomenal. He got a better score than that other student who was more gifted because he put in the time. Which leads to the next one is, I see the results of laziness and I see the results of hard work. So we have people that glide through without much effort. And the lucky ones will get a low passing grade. The unlucky ones get a failing grade. And last week we had 3 tests. I had a student who failed the first one. I gave him his test and he got really quiet. And he was pretty upset. He talked to me later and he said he was so mad at himself he's about ready to flip the table over. And I said, don't do that. We'll lag it down next time before you come in. But we moved on with the material and he did what I was describing before. He stayed late. He came in early. He asked, what time will we be here in the morning? I said, if I know you're coming, I'll be here an hour early. Okay. He and another guy showed up, and they did that like the whole rest of the week. And I was impressed. And his scores were better than, probably better than the average of the whole class. And I was proud of him, and I told him so. So that was impressive. Proverbs 16:18, pride goeth before destruction, and a haughty spirit before a fall. So it's when we think that we're immune, when it's a problem. You know, this time of year, there's a lot of politics going around, and Amy was telling me about one of the candidates had been asked if he'd ever asked forgiveness. And he said, no, I think I'm a pretty good guy, and he didn't think that was necessary. And I thought, oh, that just almost give you chills. That pride goeth before destruction. In Proverbs 14:23, in all labor there is profit, but the talk of the lips tendeth only to penury. And if you look up penury, it means extreme poverty or destitution. So the way God has created our world, if we're humble and we work hard, we tend to get the goodie. If we're proud and we think that things are owed to us and we don't want to work hard, then we're pulled back down. Whose image are we made in? You can answer if you want. God's image, right? So if we're made in God's image, is it reasonable to assume that we're capable of pretty big things? We're not going to speak things into existence, but we can accomplish some things. But we have to put in the work to develop what God's given us. One of the things I keep telling the students is that they need to balance their attitude. They need to have a confidence that they can figure it out, but they have to realize when the test is put in front of them, they get stupid. You're smart, you're capable, you can figure it out, but you get stupid. So be careful and read the questions. And it's sort of the same thing. We have confidence that God is with us. We have the Holy Spirit to help us. We know we can do well, but we're weak. So if we know we're weak, then when we're faced with a trial, we'll respond appropriately like Joseph did. Potiphar's wife tried to come after him. He was confident. He was seemed like a very confident man. But what did he do? He ran. Why? Because he knew he was weak. He's strong through Christ, but inherently weak. And he knew it. And that made him stronger because he was able to avoid those trials. So we see the results of laziness, the results of hard work, and we see the results of natural abilities put to good use and the results of pride. The next observation is, you've got to do your homework if you want to pass the test. So one of the things that's been happening since I started is they're starting to crack down on making sure the apprentices have their homework done when they come in, because they're supposed to have all of it done when they come in unless we've told them they can save part of it back. And we got lax in checking that, and we discovered that, you know, some of these guys are struggling. Why are they struggling? This is not that hard of material. It's because they only had half their lessons, and they've never seen it before. So that will get them in trouble. They end up going and seeing the committee for that. But in that situation, sometimes it's possible to take someone who hasn't done their homework and get them where they need to be before they're tested. But it's hit or miss. It depends a lot on how much natural ability they have and how much time they're willing to put in the week. But if you show me someone who's done their homework and studied and tried to find the right answer, I'll show you someone that can pass the test. Whether I help them hit the stuff out of left field or not, they'll pass it and they'll do well. So how does that apply to our Christian walk? Sometimes we worry about if there were a real persecution, or if I came under a certain trial, how would I react? Well, how do I react to small trials? Do I rely on God throughout the day, throughout the week? Or do I only pay attention to Him on Sundays and Wednesdays? If I do the homework, I'll be much better equipped for trials. If I don't, I might squeak by through the grace of God and through your help, but it's hit or miss. I don't know. So it's important that we do our homework. Our homework is we need to expose ourselves to the Scripture. We need to think about the Scripture. We need to sing songs of praise. We need to fellowship with one another and make sure we're being an asset to our brethren, because that helps us as much as it helps them, maybe more. Next observation is they all do better together. All the apprentices do better together. They love this point because they use it to push for a group test, of course, which never works. We all do better together. Why don't you let us do a group test? No. And there is a good argument for that. They'll argue, well, if I'm in the field and I don't know about something, I'm going to ask the other guys. Well, that's true. But I don't want a bunch of incompetent guys asking each other. So I've got to make sure you know it before I send you out there. So the last several weeks, I've been telling them about my own experience going through the program. When I went through the program, I have a tendency to procrastinate, which I have to actively fight. And which is why I love that T-shirt that Justin wears. It says, top 10 reasons I procrastinate. It says one, and there's nothing else on the shirt. But that's me. If left to my own devices, I have no doubt that at least half the time, the weekend before class, I'd be doing an all-nighter Friday night or Saturday night, trying to get it all done. And so when I was in class, I don't think it was my idea. I think one of the other guys approached me. But there, three other guys wanted to meet together. We were all local to this area. And they said, why don't we get together? You know, we'll start 4 weeks before we have class. We'll get together once a week somewhere and just do homework for an hour or two. So we get it done. Okay. So we did that. We'd go to Culver's in Altoona. We were there so often that the staff started to know us. We'd order a small, and they'd give us a medium. They'd bring us around samples of ice cream, and it was kind of fun. But it prevented procrastination. It helped us understand. When one of us didn't get something, one of the other ones would usually know it. And when I knew something that the others didn't know, that meant I could teach them. Nothing helps you remember something better than trying to teach it to someone else. So I got the better end of that. Well, in all his wisdom, God left us a tremendous gift. He gave us each other. How often do you suppose you would think to sing songs of praise to God or do his Lord's table if we weren't told to meet the first day of the week and do that? I'd like to be optimistic and tell myself that I would do it at least once a month, but I could see it. You get busy. When you get busy, the things that are important go on the back burner, replaced by the things that are urgent, right? Whatever screams the loudest gets the attention, and the important stuff gets left behind. But he said, okay, I want you to be part of a body. I don't care if you're a toe, a finger, a foot, an ear, a nose. I want you to be part of the body and serve a purpose. And he said, remember my son, first day of the week, take a collection, so if one of you is struggling, we can help you. He looks out for us, and he gave us each other. He gave us a family. So meeting with you fine people prompts me to do those things. I sing, I give, I hear about Christ, I study more than I would. Once in a while you put me on the schedule, and I have to study more than I would, you know, to come up with a lesson. It's good for me. So you're a tremendous blessing that shouldn't be underestimated, and you want to make sure that you serve that purpose for someone else. A pet peeve of mine is people who will go to a church service and they say, well, I'm not sure I want to keep going because I just don't feel like I got anything out of it. And my gut reaction is, well, it means you're not putting anything into it. Or a person that comes to, and they say, I just don't feel like I'm part of the group. I feel left out. Well, are you trying to make somebody else feel welcome? Because that's how you feel like part of the group. You don't think about poor me. I look around and say, well, this person looks like they're maybe a little down. Or this person hasn't had anybody come up and say hi to them. And you go talk to that person. You try to be the blessing that you're hoping someone else will be for you. But I think that's a tremendous blessing that gets overlooked. And my final observation is you'll never complete the program if you don't get in. Now, our particular program is pretty highly sought after. It's not the easiest program to get into because it gives you a good paying job on the first day. After 5 years, you have no loans, and you've earned about $200,000 if you worked 40 hours a week. Some of them are working overtime. And you get an education that's equivalent to a lot of college courses. In fact, you can get college credit. So it's a really beneficial program. And at the end, you get a license that you can take anywhere in the country and use it. So I could go to Baltimore or Texas or wherever and be to work on Monday. Just go to the hall and sign the book, and here I go. That's pretty attractive to a lot of people. But that's like a Cracker Jack toy compared to what Christ offers. It really is. What Christ offers us, forgiveness of sins and eternal life. So even if our apprenticeship offered you Donald Trump income for the rest of your life, it still would pale in comparison, because our life is a blip. It's a blip compared to what we get from Christ. Christ gives us eternal life in God's presence and forever. God gave his Son so that he can accept anyone into his program. It isn't hard to get into. You have to have perseverance to stick with it, but it's not hard to get into. If you fail, you're given another chance. You're not booted. So God gave his Son so he can accept anyone who loves him and takes advantage of Christ's blood to wash away their sins. There is no other qualifier than that. And at this time, as is our custom, we'll offer the gospel invitation. If any of you have not accepted Christ, what tremendous benefits he offers. And we'd like to help you with that as we stand and sing.